You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on WJFF.
And that's my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
Okay. The show is Like Mother, Like Son?
Yes. That's right, with
really?
A question mark.
With a question mark.
You know, it's a mother's son thing. Welcome to Like Mother, Like Son, and I'm sitting here with my son, Ramsey Adams.
And I'm sitting here with my mother, Patricia Adams, and our producer, Mark Sutton. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Great.
Good. Hey, so we got an exciting guest today. Her name is Sissy Block, and she has a show that's going to be performed at the Midtown Theater Festival this summer.
Sissy, welcome to Like Mother, Like Son.
Thank you.
And I'm going to read a little description of that show and then ask Sissy to tell us about it. This show, Love and Israel, explores the human side of Israel through the eyes of different writers who have a personal relationship with the country. A series of funny, serious, sexy, and soul-bearing monologues are performed by an ensemble cast. Tell us about this, Sissy.
Well, Love in Israel is a collection of monologues that we collected from a bunch of different people who have a personal connection with Israel, an emotional connection with Israel. And we edited them into a script and turned them into a theater production. So it's basically 12 monologues performed by an ensemble cast of now 7 people. And actually, the interesting thing about it is that the different people interrupt each other and play different roles. So if there's a he said, she said in a monologue, then that's played by different characters. So we keep it all moving. So it's not just monologue.
How'd you get this ensemble?
Well, some of the people are, I have my co-producer, Alana Lipsky, who I met in New York. She also lived in Israel for a long time. And she actually moved to New York from Israel to study acting. And she produced her showcase for her acting program. And we met shortly after that, and I kind of told her this story about love in Israel, about my relationship with Israel. I lived in Israel for 9 years and moved to New York and thought, oh, well, you know, Israel will be that place that, you know, that I used to live. And it just kept sort of following me around. And I wrote a piece about it and then really thought it would be interesting to turn it into a monologue show where we would collect a lot of people's stories. Because it's one thing, I mean, I'm not the first person who ever loved Israel or had a connection to Israel, and so it's not as, you know, interesting to just hear about me. I wanted it to be a lot of different people, because I think that's sort of the unique thing about Israel.
Could you do your opening monologue for us?
Oh, sure. Okay. The whole thing with Israel started, innocently enough, as a summer fling. I was 16, Israel was 38. It was a 6-week adventure in a foreign land. We spent sun-drenched days at the beach, from Netanya to Eilat, in starry nights on the town in Jerusalem, drinking Coke out of cans with Hebrew writing on them. I had the time of my life, and I owed it all to Israel. But it wasn't until I got home to St. Louis that I realized just how much Israel had gotten under my skin. I found myself talking incessantly about Israel, revealing facts only a teenage girl with a massive crush would think other people would find interesting. Things like, did you know that in Israel, Kit Kats are called Kif Kats? And the chocolate tastes way creamier. Did you know that in Israel, there are teenage soldiers everywhere carrying huge Uzis? No, it's not scary at all. Can you believe even the garbage men and bus drivers are Jewish there? So, yeah, you could say I had a thing for Israel. I never thought it would go any further than a teen tour crush. But by the time my junior year of college rolled around, there was Israel calling me back for more. The next thing I know, I'm sitting on an El Al flight to spend a year at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. In love, they say, timing is everything, and I landed in Ben Gurion Airport just as Iraq invaded Kuwait. People from my overseas program started leaving, but there was no way I was going to let Saddam Hussein drag me away from Israel. Not now. Not when we were just getting reacquainted. We had a red-hot Gulf War romance, and before I knew it, I was in love. After that year, I went back to the States to finish college. 2 weeks after graduation, I came back to live in Israel for good. What can I say? I followed my heart.
That's terrific.
That's great, yeah. Did you grow up in it? You were born in Israel and grew up there and then went to St. Louis and then back to Israel and to college? No?
No, not at all. Okay. I was born in Chicago. I mean, my family is from St. Louis. My dad grew up in St. Louis. My mom grew up in Pennsylvania and moved to St. Louis when she married my dad. And there's no good reason I should have anything to do with Israel. I mean, I went to, you know, Jewish camp.
Other than the fact that you're Jewish.
Yes, yes.
Well, that's something.
But I mean, you know, as opposed to a lot of the different people who I met living in Israel who grew up in sort of Zionist youth movements or their parents were Israeli. And, I was sort of this freak of nature where I'd be this, like, regular American girl who just, you know, found myself being connected to Israel. And, you know, that's the thing that I always think that it must be some sort of love thing.
Did you live on a kibbutz when you were there?
I've actually never spent more than about 4 days at a time on a kibbutz. I mean, I've volunteered there when we studied abroad a little bit, and I've got some really good friends who live on a kibbutz in the south called Kibbutz Ketorah, which is actually connected to Hadassah and Young Judea, which are, you know, Zionist movements, and actually a group of people, Americans, started it in the 70s.
Yeah, I wanted to mention about the kibbutz era. I worked at the United Nations as a guide in the 1960s, sort of early on in the 60s, and a number of guides, and not necessarily Jewish, went to live in Israel on a kibbutz. And it was almost like a precursor to American communes. That whole, the kibbutz idea is a very romantic idea. And so are there still many in Israel, or is a different pattern emerged pretty much for?
Well, I mean, they still exist, but they don't exist the way that, you know, they did back then. And I think one of the things is that the people who were born on a kibbutz, you know, the concept of them staying there and, you know, having their own families there and raising their own families there is very odd to them. And so I don't think that the idealism necessarily lasted through another generation.
Okay.
And I think that's, but I do think, I mean, there are, and actually, you know, sort of the kibbutzim in the middle of the country, those are sort of, they're actually trying to get people to come live there, and it's not as socialist as it used to be.
Right.
And actually, there's some of them. I was at a kibbutz. I was in Israel a few years ago, and there was a kibbutz I went to that actually, they bring in some of the, sometimes older people they have living on a kibbutz, you know, that came from, you know, the former, you know, Soviet Union, and
right.
And then maybe they had lived in cities, and so sometimes the kibbutz life is, you know, is good for them. So I think it's having, you know, different uses, you know.
So what was your life like? What did you do there for 9 years?
Well, it's funny, you know, I studied advertising at the University of Texas, and I had this creative advertising portfolio that I would have taken to Madison Avenue, and I was like, oh, no, I want to go to Israel instead. And so I got there with this portfolio, and I realized that I had studied abroad in Jerusalem, but the concept of living in Jerusalem, you know, didn't seem so feasible in terms of work and stuff. So I said, okay, I went to Tel Aviv, and I would go around to these advertising agencies, and, you know, they might have like one ad a year, two ads a year that would be in English. It wasn't like I could be a copywriter in Hebrew. So I actually ended up being a marketing copywriter doing like brochures.
Did you speak Hebrew?
You know, I did. And it's funny because when I studied abroad, there was really when I learned to speak Hebrew. I went to Hebrew school as a kid, and I liked to learn Hebrew, but couldn't speak. But it's funny, you kind of learn by osmosis. So I would say, you know, I remember those sort of first interviews, and I would be having them in Hebrew. You know, it was just, and then after a while, the radio broadcast, you know, you couldn't understand. Then all of a sudden, one day you understand it. It's amazing.
So what is the creative culture like in Israel? I mean, you wrote this amazing, you know, sort of play or a model. What is it? It's a play?
You know, it's a play. Yeah, I guess we've definitely connected the monologues into a play.
Now, have you? I mean, is there a deep culture of playwriting and acting in Israel too? And did you partake in that, or did you really come to New York and do that?
You know, there is, and I did, but I did not partake in it. My co-producer did. There's a theater called Center Stage Theater that's in Jerusalem. It's more community theater like. And Alana actually participated in a lot of plays and stuff there. And I actually attended a few plays there. I remember, you know, seeing Little Shop of Horrors, you know, done there. Actually, at Hebrew University, I, you know, went to plays. But no, I had kind of nothing to do with it. It's almost like a topic-specific thing that sort of, you know, came out of really wanting to do something with my relationship with Israel when I wasn't in Israel anymore.
Now, speaking of that, you're going to do Love in Israel this summer at the 8th Annual Midtown International Theater Festival, which is coming up July 16th through August 5th.
Yep.
And it's the press release says, I'm just sort of interested in this press release, hummus, Hebrew, and hookahs. What is that?
A hookah is like a like a water pipe. You know,
I don't know what a hookah is either, Mom.
That's a hookah.
That's a hookah.
We have a...
Am I missing something here?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Are.
Maybe we don't need to go further. I know what hummus is.
Yeah.
All
right,
well, you'd like the hummus after you had the hookah.
Okay. There is one character, a bit character in our piece called My Cat and My Heart Are in Israel, about a guy who went to study medicine, and he was living in Beersheba in the south, and he kind of befriends all of his neighbors, and one definitely smoked a hookah.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Sissy Block. She's got a show called Love in Israel that's going to be at the Midtown Theater Festival in New York City. And we'll be right back on Like Mother, Like Son on Radio Jah. You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on Radio Jeff. Our guest today is Sissy Block, and here's Patricia to tell us a little bit about how you can see this show.
You can get tickets online at www.smarttix.com, or you can call 212-868-4444. And this show, I'm sort of interested in the various topics that are going to be in the show. Israeli culture, Israeli food, and even Israeli cats. Also about a New Yorker's experience of serving in the Israeli army and separating from Israel. First of all, I just want to hear about these cats.
Well, you know, it's funny. They would say the cats are like rats in Israel. The cats are everywhere. I think they may have brought in, the legend is in Tel Aviv at least, that they brought in cats to eat the rats, and
right.
Then the cats stayed. And so there's all this sort of culture of outdoor cats, you know, whatever kind of apartment building there will be. And there'll also be like a cat lady who's out there with a bag of cat food, you know, feeding the cats and stuff like that. So it's more usual you would even have a cat that could be the cat for your whole building, you know, that you might feed it a little bit. Or
so people sort of adopt street cats,
yeah.
As it were. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, another comment, a woman who saw this talked about how there was one of the monologues about a woman who related to Israel through music. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's actually a monologue written by my co-producer, Alana Lipsky. And, you know, it's that thing where anytime you would hear a song, I'm sure it would happen in any culture, that it takes you back to a different moment in a different place. And I think that the message of that one really is that, you know, Israeli songs sort of have this current of a theme that always ends up being about, you know, about hope, you know, about this sort of resiliency, about, you know, next year being better, about it'll be okay, and it'll, you know, that sort of feeling that no matter what happens, you know, we're still here and things are going to be good. And it's those are kind of messages that are always in Hebrew music.
Well, you know, in the West, we sort of think about Israeli music as da-da, that sort of thing. But is there also a pop scene?
And absolutely.
But is it different because it is kind of related to what you just mentioned.
The beach, the dance raves. The Israeli dance parties are the best in the world, right?
Well, yeah, that's also they have. That's sort of the European, you know, culture that's kind of come to Tel Aviv. That's where there's all the, you know, dance and techno and that kind of stuff that comes from Europe. But I would say I'm not sure how different, actually, Israeli pop music would be to, like, you know, Simon and Garfunkel, you know, that, you know, the same types of musicians from, like, let's say the 70s, you know, kind of sound like the American musicians, but the words are just in Hebrew. And,
okay.
You know, I actually learned a lot of Hebrew listening to music over and over again and learning lyrics. And I think that, you know, so it's not all that different, I would say, the pop scene, but there definitely is. And there's definitely, you know, singers that people are connected to. And
so what fascinates me is how you went from, you know, having an idea about a play or a monologue and actually turning it around and getting it produced and having it, you know, in New York, the great, you know, the hardest town to break into in theater. You know, how did that happen? I mean, and was it luck? Did you have somebody who knew the routes to the stage, or how? Tell us a little bit about the process.
I think it's just a little bit of not knowing enough to know that it's a hard thing to do, and not really having like it be sort of an ambition for it to go forward. But it just sort of worked out organically like that. I mean, having a co-producer and us working together, you know, has been amazing, because, you know, I may have a lot of ideas. I come from a marketing background, and she comes from a grant writing and theater background, and so we kind of really balance each other out. And so, you know, when one person kind of loses steam, the other person's like, oh, I've got an idea, let's enter this festival. And then she writes the document, and, you know, if she wrote the document herself and had to send it in, she might have the feeling, oh, God, this isn't that good. And then I'm like, oh, that looks really good, just change this, and, you know, throw in some marketing stuff. And so I think that's really, you know, you know, how we did it. You know, I think that it's just... and any time there was like, well, the right way to do this would be that, I'd be like, ah, forget about that. Let's just do it. You know?
Now, about the people who do the monologues, you all are living in America. Do any of you think you want to go back? Or is this sort of a nostalgic thing, but none of you actually plan to go back and live in Israel?
Well, to be clear, some of the people in it, I mean, most of the people, I perform my own stories. And we actually have two new people who are performing their own stories. One, his name is Avi Reinhardt. He's actually from Minneapolis, and his parents met in a kibbutz in Israel, and he's going to be singing a song. And we have a comedian named Mindy Raff, who, you know, appears on VH1 and is really on the comedy circuit, and she's going to be performing her own piece about going on this Birthright Israel trip and the guy who kind of talked her into going and what happened with that. But the rest of the people are actors. And so that play one or two roles. So actually, some of our people do live in Israel. Some of the people who wrote the pieces.
Right.
And some live outside of Israel. But it's funny because at least at this very moment, it doesn't really seem that it's causing them to go one way or the other.
Right.
And, you know, it is sort of funny. You know, one of the monologues that I is called the Kenya-Israel Highway, and it's actually a...
Kenya?
Yes, because there was a terrorist attack in 2002, I think, on an Israeli-owned hotel in Kenya. And the writer, Dina Kraft, had actually left Israel. It was around the same time that I had left Israel to go work for the AP in Johannesburg. And so she got called to cover this attack.
Okay.
And from that, realized, you know, saw the Israeli soldiers, you know, come there to help, you know, it's sort of an aid mission, and realized she was going to go back. And on a visit, I talked to Dina, and she was thinking about moving to New York. And she said to me, you know, what's it like to go to New York? And I said, you know, you got to think a little bit, because you move places like that, and it's not so easy to go back. It's not so easy to just pick up your life again, like when you graduated college and you had nothing and nowhere to go, and you just go start in a new place. It's not as easy just to go back. So I told her, I'm like, think about it. You know, think about it. And she actually, you know, lives in Tel Aviv, you know, and she
stayed there. Yeah. Well, that your story brings up one other issue, which is the Palestine-Israeli issue, which really does cast a shadow, I would assume, over life, in spite of the fact that you celebrate life in these monologues. I mean, life in Israel and the positives. And this, as has been said in some of the reviews, this gives those of us who've never been there the human face and a different side.
Right.
But Could you just speak to that?
I think what my mom is asking is, could you just answer the Israeli-Palestine conflict question once and for all right now on the radio station?
Actually, you know, it's funny. We actually have a monologue in there that it's a soldier who's on reserve duty, and it's a writer. His name's Jonathan Elkins, and he lives in Tel Aviv, and he's on his reserve duty. And Saeb Erekat keeps coming in and out of his checkpoint, and how they sort of form like a, you know, a connection, meeting there at this checkpoint. And, you know, it's funny, Jonathan's writing is all sort of about this, where, you know, you find sort of the human element in, you know, if you could just meet someone face-to-face like that, like, what it would be like, and if we all could sort of meet face-to-face like that. I mean, I think that the Palestinian conflict actually is one of the things that makes Israel kind of hard to love. Because it's not when you are connected to Israel this way, you know, you don't necessarily have the feeling like that you want to, you know, support Israel and whatever it does, no matter what. It's right. Not that kind of relationship, and so it kind of, you know, it makes it hard, and it makes it hard to be there in some ways, because, you know, sometimes, you know, when you do think about it, you know, you realize that there's this other people, and, you know, then their leaders aren't necessarily doing anything, you know, to help them right. have the kind of life that you have, and how can you help them? And it does make it hard.
Now, in your title, you talk about the enduring love for Israel. So perhaps this is a good time for you to do your final monologue, which I guess refers to that.
You didn't meet me in New Jersey, was how I put it to a boyfriend I live with in Tel Aviv when he suggested that I leave Israel and move with him to Vancouver. For me, it was simple. If he loved me, he'd have to understand that living in Israel was part of the package. Was that too much to ask? Well, he moved out, and I decided to start dating the natives. Now, I never felt like the hot hunk of Israeli man was exactly my type, but if it meant I got to live my life in Israel, I had to be open to the possibility that the right Saber was out there for me somewhere. However, dating actual Israelis proved even more complicated. Meeting an American girl in Tel Aviv, they love the idea of being whisked off to live in the States for a few years, or forever. They couldn't imagine why I'd actually want to live in Israel by choice. So, as I stood alone on the balcony of my rooftop apartment in Tel Aviv, I felt like Rapunzel, waiting for my American Zionist dream man to climb up my braids and join me to build my dream life in Israel. I'd be the matriarch of my American-Israeli family. He'd get a job that paid its salary in American dollars and took us on frequent trips to the States that allowed us to see our respective families just the right amount. Together, we'd raise beautiful, confident Israeli children, a boy named Asaf and a girl named Aviv, who'd speak perfect English and bicker with each other at the dinner table in unaccented Hebrew. If Israel really wanted to keep me here, it would send me someone to love, who loved me and loved Israel, and we'd all live happily ever after. But in my quest to find love in Israel, I can never seem to find someone whose connection to the country quite meshed with mine. So when I moved to New York, it was important to me that any love interest I'd have would understand my love for Israel. However, for as many Jewish men as there are in New York, finding someone with a healthy love and respect for Israel is harder than you'd imagine. I'd go on dates with perfectly acceptable Jewish guys who'd say things like, "I have no desire to ever go to Israel." It's like telling me my baby's ugly. How could I get involved with someone who'd say such a thing? Then, a fellow Israel lover responded to my online dating profile that stated as the place I could be if I could be anywhere in the world as on the balcony of my old apartment in Tel Aviv. On our first date in a Middle Eastern restaurant, I confided in him that I found it hard to date American Jews who didn't understand my connection to Israel. He totally agreed and said, "Israel will always be an important part of my life. I need someone who understands that." He had me at Shalom. Before Shabbat was over, we were a couple. I cooked dinners for him with all made-in-Israel ingredients. I read over his shoulder as he devoured hardbacks about the Six-Day War or the life of Abba Iban. And every night when I whispered Laila Tov to him, I was so happy I'd met someone who felt good saying those words back to me. Before I knew it, we were headed back to Israel on a homecoming trip together. And that's when Israel began to pull us apart. He could see in my eyes how much I loved Israel, how I glowed just walking down the streets of my old neighborhood in Tel Aviv, how seeing the shopkeepers in the square below my apartment brought tears to my eyes. "I just don't understand how you could have walked away from all this," he said. "I'd move back in a heartbeat if you come with me," I told him. But he couldn't see himself living in Israel. What would he do for work? His Hebrew wasn't that good. all the rational reasons. "Would you have wanted to be with me if I didn't love Israel?" he asked. I didn't have a good answer to that question. As far as I was concerned, being with someone who loved Israel was the next best thing to being there. But after seeing me in Israel, he never looked at me quite the same again. When we got back to New York, I moved out of his apartment and tried to figure out a way to move on. Love and Israel. I wanted both, but suddenly I had neither. Part of me figured that if everything happens for a reason, then maybe this was all happening because I was meant to meet someone who'd take me back to Israel for good. But after going on several first dates with guys who had varying degrees of Israel connection, it started to sink in that maybe having a connection to Israel didn't necessarily lead to a love connection. So I lowered my threshold for the degree to which someone I dated needed to love Israel. He'd have been there before and or be positively predisposed to the place. I was not going to let Israel have such a say in my love life anymore. That didn't stop me from blabbering on all night on the first date with a guy who I actually felt a genuine connection with. I went home thinking, why did I have to go on about Israel all night? He's going to think I'm not interested in getting involved with anyone here. Fortunately, he asked me on again. And over a glass of red wine, he asked me point blank why I left Israel. I rattled off my standard answer, that I felt like I'd hit a ceiling there professionally, socially, creatively. But he pressed on and asked me if I had to give one reason why I left. One reason, what would it be? Love, I blurted out, shocked and flustered at having actually answered that question truthfully. So into the silence, I repeated love and sat there even more flustered by the fact that I just told someone I'm on a second date with that I left in the country I lived in for 9 years and loved more than anything for the prospect of finding real love in my life. And that's when he reached out across the table, grabbed my hand and said, I understand. And holding my shaking hands, he repeated, I understand. So after we've been dating for a while, I worked up the courage to ask him if he felt like I talked about Israel too much on our first date. No, he said. I like that you could be so passionate about something. I like the way your eyes lit up when you talked about Israel. Really? And maybe that's all anyone's looking for someone who's willing to understand the things that are most important to them, no matter what those things are. But maybe especially if one of those things is love and the other is Israel.
Terrific, Sissy. And now maybe you can tell us where we can get see these performances.
Yeah, the Midtown International Theater Festival, we're going to be at the Jewel Box in the Workshop Theater on 36th Street. I think it's 312 36th Street on the fourth floor. And our first performance is Wednesday night, July 18th at 5:30 p.m., and you can order tickets online on SmartTix, which is www.smarttix, that's smart, S-M-A-R-T, tix, T-I-X, .com, or you can call their number, which I think you have there. We'd love everyone who's listening to come see our show.
And I'll also like to remind our listeners that they can visit our website, www.likemotherlikeson.org, and we'll have a link to the show on our site as well.
Yeah, Sissy, this is great. Congratulations. It's really funny, entertaining, and obviously passionate.
Right. This was great.
Thanks so
much. Thanks for coming
into
the studio
me.
Today. This is the Borscht Belt, in case you didn't know. This is following in a great tradition.
Coming home.
Thanks for being with us, Sissy.
Thanks so much.
And good night for Like Mother, Like Son. And there's my son, Ramsey Adams.
And that was my mom, Patricia Adams, and our producer, Mark Sutton. Good night.
Good night.